Thank you. Well, what I would like to try and do today is talk about the problem of evil, and I thought rather than talk about it in a very general sense, I'd use the subject of war and the origins of war as a way of talking about it. Let me just begin by saying that the project that I mentioned the other night is that I'm interested in a depth psychological approach to spirituality that is based on our individual experience of the sacred. And I believe that there's a lot of evidence that I've tried to share with you that it's possible to develop an individual spirituality that's not dependent on any pre-existing doctrines or dogmas, that's based purely on personal connection to the sacred. So if that's the case, that's the project, what then about the problem of evil, which is obviously an enormous challenge to any form of spirituality? And unless the depth psychological approach has something to offer, it won't be much help, because we already have a great deal of accumulated wisdom in the traditions about the problem of evil. So what does depth psychology have to offer? I think it does have something to offer, because I think what depth psychology can do that the traditions have not been able to do so far is tell it that depth psychology can tell you something about the unconscious underpinnings of evil, what it is that's driving evil behavior. And the traditions, in all their comments about evil, mostly focus on the conscious aspects of evil. They give good advice and so on about what to do with it and so on, but it all has to do with consciousness. It really is only depth psychology that talks about the unconscious underpinnings of it. Now, this is a very important problem in our culture at large, because, as you know, our media, the movie industry and magazines, newspapers and so on, are constantly filled with accounts of evil behavior. They say in the news business, they say if it bleeds, it leads. So every time there's some major serious catastrophe, that's always the first thing on the news, or always on the front page of the newspaper. So why is that? It seems that somehow the media people know that evil fascinates us. We're always interested in it. We're always drawn to it. And this fascination is no accident. What is the psychology of fascination of any kind, actually, whether it's evil or anything else? The theory is... I should perhaps just add here a little word about theory, because one of the very few things I remember someone telling me in medical school was half the things we tell you are wrong, but unfortunately we don't know which half. So I mention a lot of this has to do with theory, so I would hold it lightly rather than tightly. But anyway, at the moment the theory is that things are fascinating to us when they correspond to something in ourselves. So if you go to a movie or read a story or a myth or a fairy tale or a book or something, it will be interesting to you if it corresponds to some dynamic in your own soul. Otherwise, it won't be particularly interesting. So evil, because it's fascinating, must resonate with something in us. Otherwise, I think it would be unreported. And you'll notice that if you look at our cultural images of the extremes of good and evil, say people like Adolf Hitler, Saddam Hussein, Mother Teresa, Gandhi, these kind of extremes are quite fascinating to us as well. We're very interested in these extremes. So they are, I think, quite numinous. Now, obviously, this is the problem of evil is very pressing because of the development of our technology. We could now destroy all the life on the planet. So this is a terribly serious problem. And the need for an effective response has never been more urgent because of that. But in spite of that, it seems to me that the traditional Western monotheistic approaches to evil don't have a much effect. I mean, we've had a couple of thousand years now of this. If you went to the FDA and you said, we've been trying this medicine for 2,000 years and we're not sure it really works, I think they would say, well, why don't you try something else? Okay. Doesn't? Yeah, that's right. We have the Western tradition's responses. We have moral teachings. We have threats of punishment. We have spiritual exercises to prevent it, strictures for the guilty, compassion for the victims, and so on and so on. But the traditions have some intractable difficulties that I'll come to in a moment that I think depth psychology overcomes. But before I go into that, I want to make the point, just to forestall that this question always arises. The depth psychological attempt to understand evil, to understand what it is in the soul which is driving evil behavior, is not an attempt to justify it. Okay, this is very important. There are people who resent any psychological approaches to evil. I found this particularly some years ago when I was studying the Holocaust literature. Some people are afraid that if you explain evil like that psychologically, you risk excusing it. And some of the historians, for example, will point out there are pictures of Adolf Hitler as a little baby wearing his white communion gown, and he just looks like a little baby with a white frilly sort of 19th century communion gown, just looks like any other baby. So then they say, well, if you psychologists will now explain to us how this little baby became the monster who was responsible for all those deaths, what are you trying to take him off the hook? Are you trying to make him a victim with your explanations? That's been the problem. That's why people have resented it. Will you then desecrate the memory of all the victims of the Nazi era if you do that? That's one argument, and I understand the argument, but I think it's wrong. I think there's a different view, maybe because I have a medical background, that if you have a disease, you can only really effectively treat a disease if you understand it deeply. So otherwise your treatments are rather superficial, they're just symptomatic. So it seems to me that since I think of evil as a kind of disease in the personality, the better we understand it psychologically, the more effective will our approaches to it be. So I think that's the counter argument. Now the next point is that a response to evil that helps, that's useful to one individual, may not be helpful to everybody. Depth psychology is not in a position to offer an absolute moral philosophy. We can't say, here's the law, this is what God said, and this is true for everyone. That's just not the method of psychology. The method of psychology is really, I think, an approach to the individual, or maybe a small group. But I don't think we can know what... The psychologist is not in a position to say what the will of God is for everybody. So we have a different approach to it. Then there's the whole problem of whose interpretation of the will of God is correct and all the rest of it. So depth psychology is concerned with human experience, and it's not concerned with arguments about absolutes like the will of God. All right. So the next problem that arises is, do we know the nature of good and evil? They're very difficult to define clearly, actually. When the inquisitors burned witches because they said it was necessary to save the witches' souls, were these men evil, or were they simply ignorant and unconscious and stupid? Which were they? If you say that they were evil, what kind of criteria are you using? For example, would you say that a volcano or a poisonous snake or a dangerous animal is evil? You probably not. You would say that they're simply acting according to their nature. Okay, but they certainly cause a great deal of fear and pain and suffering. So we can't just say that evil is our name for whatever causes suffering. We could say that. Some people do say that what we call evil is just the word we give to whatever causes us pain and suffering. That would be one approach. The difference between the wild animal, the volcano, and the inquisitor is that the human being is evil when he is or should be conscious of the damage that he's doing, all right, and is able to not behave in such a way, then we would say that that's more like what evil is. Now, if we say it's a matter of consciousness, then we run the difficulty of saying that evil is actually a product of unconsciousness or ignorance. So that's why Jesus, when Jesus was on the cross, he said, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." He was the first depth psychologist. He understood that what they were doing was a matter of unconsciousness. Well, if evil is a matter of unconsciousness, and ignorance, then evil is not a primary quality. It's not some absolute natural constant like the speed of light or the law of gravity. It's really a product of ignorance and unconsciousness. Would you accept that? If it's a matter of unconsciousness, then the way to address evil, of course, is to make things conscious. So then, and it's a matter of knowledge. So then Socrates was correct. Nobody deliberately does evil. They do evil because they're ignorant. Then ignorance is not primary. Then, of course, we have the issue of freedom of choice. Could the person have done otherwise? There are philosophers who say that evil really means that you know what you're doing is evil. It's not that you're unconscious. Unconsciousness is sort of secondary. The real evil occurs when you know that what you're doing is evil and you do it anyway. That's real wickedness. Otherwise, you just may be unconscious or ignorant or stupid, and you may not be quite as wicked and so on. You see how this starts to shade into gray. It gets quite difficult to be rigid about this. The difficulty there is the issue of freedom of choice. Could the person have chosen to have done otherwise? And I'm going to leave that to my talk on non-duality a little bit later. If we say that selfishness is the root of evil behavior, we know now a great deal about the psychology of selfishness. It arises from fear, from narcissism, from laziness. And again, that reduces evil to something else. Okay? Sometimes evil results from malignant narcissism, a kind of inflated sense of one's own importance with no capacity for empathy for other people. So I have to talk about the problem of empathy a little bit. The point I'm trying to make is that from a psychological point of view, it seems that the nature of good and evil in their essence are really kind of metaphysical questions. It's completely possible that at a transcendent level of reality, what we call good and evil are two aspects of the unitary processes of nature. From that point of view, there are qualities such as hatred and greed and violence and envy and so on, but there's no particular need to label these qualities as good or evil. They're just natural forces that we, and some of them we don't like. When we say that they're good or evil, these are categories given to them by the ego. And then what the ego is then doing is what the ego always does, which is fragmenting reality. Reality is a whole, reality is a unity, and the ego is splitting it up into fragments, saying, I don't like this and I like that and so on. So I think what depth psychology has to offer is not to talk about good and evil as cosmic principles, as metaphysical absolutes, but as human experiences, and that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about some psychological explanations for behavior that we consider to be evil, and not get tangled in questions of absolute definition. So I'm using evil as a shorthand term here for what we judge to be evil. Now, the other point that I want to make is that it's obvious that another reason that we can't say whether there is such a thing as absolute or cosmic or metaphysical evil is it looks like socially our concepts of evil have changed over time. In our culture, we would define it a certain way. Other cultures at other periods of history would define it differently. We would say that if evil is the intention to dominate or exploit other people, behavior that is anti-life, anti-love, anti-relational, destructive for its own sake, consciously inflicting cruelty on another sentient being for one's own purposes, denying the humanity of another person, depriving that person of his or her civil rights, and so on. These would be our categories, and most people would agree with them. There might be some others. But in other cultures, there would be other examples. So we have to remember that, for example, in Victorian times, there was child labor, and then just before that, there was slavery. Women didn't have the vote. There were all kinds of things going on that we now look back on and say those were evils that at the time people took for granted. So what's going on in our culture at the moment that everyone takes for granted and in 100 years people might look back on and say, how could they do that? There might be all kinds of things. So our concept of evil changes with the culture and with the geographical period. So I think we have to be a little careful about trying to find rigid definitions of evil. I just want to say a little bit about the fact that I don't think the Western monotheistic traditional approaches to evil work very well. They don't work for me. The intractable problem that the traditions have always had is that they insist that God is both good and omnipotent. All good and omnipotent. The problem is that if you have a God who is omnipotent, so he can intervene to prevent evil, but does not, if he does not, how can you say he's all good? And if he cannot, how can you say he's omnipotent? And that's been the difficulty that they've all struggled with, that wanting the divine to be all good and omnipotent, both at the same time. Now, there's a whole series of what are called theodicies. Shall I write that word down, or are you familiar with it? Write it down. A theodicy is an attempt to justify God in the presence of evil, to explain why the divine allows evil and so on. Now, I have here a whole list of them because I've spent a long time searching through trying to find one that works. And for me, none of them really works. I give you just a typical kind of... a typical theodicy is what's called the free will defense. The free will defense says that if you're God and you're going to give people choice and free will to choose, then you have to have both good and evil in order that people can have something to choose. You have to have both, otherwise the whole notion of choice and free will would be meaningless. So that's the typical free will defense. The reason it doesn't work is that it's obvious that you could just give people different degrees of goodness to choose from. I think if that possibility occurs to me, it probably would have occurred to God. So it's, I think, a very feeble defense. And then, of course, there are lots of people who simply obviously have no free will because they're so possessed by intense emotions their behavior is completely out of their control. There's a related argument that says, oh, well, we have to have pain to know pleasure and so on. But that would ignore the extraordinary amount of pain that people experience. And presumably God could have created this pleasure-pain distinction without creating quite so much pain and so on. Well, there's a whole series of these kind of theodicies. And for me, none of them are very convincing. I can talk about them in more detail if you like later on, but I think there are better ways to understand it than that. All right, so I want to say a little bit about war now as an example of evil behavior, and I want to talk about why we have wars from a psychological point of view. What is it that makes people who are, in peacetime are quite ordinary behave in ways that cause such incredible suffering? Now, obviously, there's a wide range of explanations from different disciplines. The social scientists will tell us that war is a response to political and territorial and socioeconomic conditions and religious differences and so on. But, of course, culture is not independent of psychology. I mean, obviously, all those factors are going on when there's a war, but there are also psychological factors, which are the ones that I'll talk about. The structures of society obviously have to reflect our psychology, because society is made up of people with psyches. And people, and especially politicians, have complex inner lives and complex motivations for behavior. And the contribution of depth psychology is that we can look at some of these motives, and that's what I want to do. There are historians that say that the causes of war are too complex to understand. In fact, a lot of people say that it's impossible to say what the cause of anything is, because causes have causes, which have causes, and causes have causes. And so you end up back at the Big Bang in a kind of infinite regress. So I don't want to get into that kind of infinite regress. I just want to show what depth psychology can offer the study of war that casts light on the psychological origins of the problem. What's going on in the minds of those who want war? And there clearly are people who want war. What are the unconscious motives for war? And also, Is there a spiritual or archetypal dimension to war? And I want to make the case that there is, that this is part of what Jung calls the dark side of the self. So I want to make a case for these ideas. There are emotional problems that drive wars in the minds of people who want to go to war. These are problems like fear and rage and hatred and the need to dominate others and envy and shame. These are all going on in the minds of the politicians. Some of them, of course, have their origins in childhood. And for some people, childhood trauma is reworked by inflicting it on other people. Later on, I'll talk a little bit about Hitler and how that was true for him. What happens is that when one is tormented in a cruel way in childhood, sometimes one can try to master that trauma by inflicting it on other people. And then we have the revenge cycle. Revenge, of course, is just a primitive response to being hurt. It's an attempt to restore self-esteem, redress the balance, restore one's self-esteem, and balance things according to a kind of eye for an eye. And that attitude, unfortunately, has been part of the Western tradition, the Western monotheistic tradition, that Italian law, the eye for an eye. Although we've paid lip service to forgiveness, because we know that revenge just produces more violence. A violent solution to an attack, simply common sense tells you, just produces more violence. But we don't emphasize forgiveness very much. The whole issue of forgiveness is a huge one. It's very difficult, because when you forgive, you have to write off the debt that you're owed. It's as if you're owed a kind of moral debt. Nowadays, the psychologists talk about this in terms of grudge theory. They say that you have to give up the grudge that you have. And it's very difficult to give up the grudge if you've been narcissistically wounded. Anyway, I won't go into that in more detail at the moment. I think that forgiveness evolved in parallel with revenge so that we wouldn't destroy each other. Otherwise, we would just be in a cycle of revenge and we would destroy each other. Now, I'm suggesting that the human sense of self is very intrinsically very fragile. The human ego, the small s self, the personal self, is very fragile because we are ridden with fears about survival and death anxiety and so on. And the more we are afraid, the more we need to control other people to try to master our fear, because we feel that if we can control what's going on, we're in less danger. That's how we try and cope with our fear. And that explains the behavior of politicians, some of our politicians, who usually are quite frightened people, which is why they need to go into a profession where they control other people. One of the main mental mechanisms, what we call defense mechanisms, of the sociopathic personality is the need to have omnipotent control over other people. And not all sociopaths are violent and criminal. Many sociopaths with that particular mental makeup go into professions where you can control other people, the military, the police, politics, business. Those kind of professions where you can have total control over other people are full of antisocial, sociopathic personalities. I'm afraid many of our politicians have this kind of personality. Yes, exactly. Any field where you have to dominate and control other people. See, people who don't have that particular dynamic don't need to go into those professions. That's part of the difficulty. I'll come back to that. So that's one problem. Then we have an atavistic anxiety called predator anxiety, okay, which I'll talk more about, which has to do with the fact that our early hominid ancestors were prey of wild beasts, and that becomes very important. We've inherited that fear of being prey, and so we've become predators. We are excellent predators. War also, so that when we're attacked, like the 9/11, that stirs up this very primitive predator anxiety. War also results from our narcissistic difficulties, our need to maintain self-esteem in the face of a threat. Take 9/11 as a good example. How could you do that to us? Don't you realize how important we are? That's a narcissistic issue, and that produces a kind of need to retaliate. I'll show you. It's the same as road rage. You know, you get cut off on the freeway and you're going to show this guy, how can you do that to me? It's a rather primitive response to being wounded. So overall, from a psychological point of view, I'm going to suggest that war is actually an emotional disorder, a kind of emotional illness. I also want to show that at the spiritual level, war is a process of ritual sacrifice. Of course, sacrifice of the young who get killed. War allows ecstasy, it allows a sense of transcendence, and a feeling of being part of a totality. It is not a simple phenomenon. The Holocaust, or the whole Nazi movement, actually, I should have said, at one level was an example of the dark side of the spirit. It may sound hard to say this, but these things are dark forms of dark spirituality. They're not only psychological problems. And I'll try and show how these levels are linked, the psychological and the spiritual, because we know that our spirituality is often used to contain our emotional difficulties. That's why Jung said that religions are psychotherapeutic systems. We use them to contain our emotional difficulty, and if we're honest, we'll find that we do that. Then I want to suggest a solution at the end based on the transformation of consciousness. Now, I have to begin with talking a little bit about the problem of human aggression, obviously, in this context. I just want to tell you some of the discredited ideas. The one discredited idea is that aggression is biologically programmed. It's in the genes, you can't escape it, and it's inevitable. That's pretty much gone now, because most people feel it's too simplistic. It would suggest that aggression is completely programmed and there's nothing we can do about it. And I don't think that's true. And the other problem with the idea of innate aggression, as if it's somehow in your genes and you can't help it, is that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, and then you have to become resigned to violence. But in fact, non-violence is also very powerful. Think of Gandhi and so on. Non-violence, of course, does not, I don't need to tell this group, does not work by coercion, but more by persuasion. So it doesn't produce the kind of backlash that violence always produces. The difficulty with non-violence is that it requires empathy rather than a kind of instinctive retaliation. And empathy is very, very difficult when one has been narcissistically wounded. It's then very difficult to feel into the feelings of the one who has wounded us and try to imagine why this has happened and then respond out of that. That would have been a much more mature response to 9/11, of course. Actually, I personally think that it's far more important to pay attention to understanding violence itself than to try to foster non-violence. I think it's too early at the moment. I actually think we should, at the moment, try and understand violence, and we'll get to non-violence when we understand violence. Anyway, that may be debatable. Then there are a series of other unhelpful theories. There's Freud, who talked about an instinct for aggression. And there are sociobiologists who talk about war as the result of male sexual selection. There are sociobiologists who talk about war as a process that accelerates cultural evolution. But to say that war is an instinct is not an explanation. It just says that we want war because it's in us to want war. I don't find that much of an explanation. And if war is an instinct, how is it inherited? There's no real good evidence that violence is inherited. It may just be learned. Children are treated very violently, and if you treat children violently, they just learn to be violent. And many people go to great lengths to avoid war. So violence can't simply be a matter of inheritance. That's too simple. Do we also inherit the need for peace? Most of us want peace. Is that inherited as well? This inheritance notion, I think, is much too simple. War and the preparation for war and the training for war are far too complicated to be just written off as instinct. And then if we say that war and peace are archetypal, which would be a reasonable thing to say, an archetype is just a pure potential. The archetype in itself is pure potential. Then what makes it incarnate into actual behavior, either as war or peace? What is it in us when we experience those potentials that makes us end up one way or the other, either in war or in peace? See, part of the difficulty with the instinct theory is that human beings have an inbuilt resistance to killing other human beings. We don't like to kill other human beings. That's why the military has to program soldiers to learn to kill. They call it boot camp, but actually what it is that it's the fact that people don't like to kill. They have to be taught and trained to kill. That's why in hunting societies, there is guilt about killing animals. The animal that's killed for food is apologized to, and there's a ritual atonement for killing and so on. So we have to train people to kill. And so tribal cultures use elaborate ceremonies to make people into warriors. And sometimes people need drugs to help them to kill and so on. We have the ritual of boot camp, okay? Social pressures, uniforms, face paints. And that transforms ordinary young people into killers. The way they do that is by turning them into automatons who are not allowed any individuality. That's the ritual process. We program young soldiers to do as they're told, using military discipline as the excuse, which insists on conformity with the group. That's actually a method of training people to be able to kill. And then no person is allowed to think for himself. And if you do enough marching and drilling and shouting and all the rest of it, then you're part of a very tight-knit group. That seems to be gratifying. And the way it's gratifying is that you lose personal boundaries and you develop a kind of bonding with other people. And I think you develop a kind of trance state, a kind of ecstatic state of being part of the larger group. And I think this state of mind is very important because it's a way of dissolving one's personal boundaries and experiencing a kind of underlying wholeness, which is the truth, as I'll talk about tomorrow, which is the reality. But these are ways in which people are induced to feel that wholeness. The problem is that after the killing is over, it's very difficult for these soldiers to readapt to normal society. Many new soldiers are not prepared for the reality of killing other people and seeing one's friends killed. As we now know, there's a very serious price to pay for this kind of behavior in terms of guilt and emotional pain that can be lifelong. That's why Native American tribes, when the warriors come home from a war, they purify warriors. They have ceremonies of purification for their warriors so that they will be restored to a peaceful state. They reinitiate them into a peaceful state so that they won't cause trouble in the community, which we don't do, and so they do cause trouble in the community. So not only is there very little evidence for an innate killer instinct, people have to be trained to kill, I don't think the evolutionary argument works either, because peace surely would be more conducive to human evolution than war, I would imagine. And I don't think there's any use in explanations like the culture of militarism, because I don't think that explains anything. I mean, can the reason for war just be utilitarian? A fight over territory? Was territory really the reason that 60 million people were killed in World War II? And I don't know how many millions have died since then. Well, it's been suggested that war is the result of the cynical manipulation of a powerful elite for their own benefit. It's been suggested that war just is a function of the Y chromosome or testosterone. Testosterone, by the way, is not the reason. It's been blamed for causing the violence that boys have rather than girls, but it's not true. Testosterone doesn't cause aggression. Testosterone levels are actually lower in aggressive boys than in normal boys. That's the science. And before puberty, testosterone levels are the same in boys and girls. So you can forget testosterone. That's not the reason. The reason that and all boys experience a surge in testosterone levels at puberty, but they don't all become violent. So forget the testosterone explanation. It's the differential treatment of boys and girls that makes boys violent. It's the way that boys are socialized makes them violent, not the testosterone. They're punished more violently and more frequently. They're less nurtured and tend to be ignored emotionally, and all that fosters violence. It's not testosterone. And then there's the theory that wars are begun by elite males, think of the Rumsfeld, Cheney kind of people, and fought by low-status males who come from poverty and join the army because they have to and so on. And so there's a theory that the older men in authority are hostile to the strength and attractiveness and sexual energy of the young. These are all sociological explanations. I think they're a little bit simplistic myself. Wars are usually more destructive than utilitarian. They often cost the winners more than they gain in terms of money. So wars are clearly self-destructive. So they're not just the result of bad economic times either. That's another misunderstanding. Most wars actually occur during times of economic upswing. World War I began when the European countries were starting to recover economically. And it was a period of expansion. And World War II began as Germany actually was starting to recover from its economic problems. So it's not just a matter of economic distress. Well, there's another theory of war. There's an anthropological theory of war, which says that war has persisted because it's prestigious and exciting. As men stopped hunting game animals because of agriculture replaced hunting, the men didn't have enough to do, so they had to have some way to release their hunting associations and so on. So war gives them something to do, something manly, and helps them feel like real men. Okay, so Barbara Ehrenreich said, men make war because war makes them men. It has a kind of initiatory function. I think that's what she's talking about without saying it. Another explanation is that the cause of war is war itself. War is a kind of epidemic. We go to war in response to war, or we go to war because we've been attacked. Our national pride was offended when we're attacked. And defense is necessary. And so when we're attacked, our mythology tells us, this is the great danger of mythology, our mythology tells us that we have to respond in kind. Defense is necessary. Otherwise, we'll be lost. And then atrocities and the need for revenge, of course, just escalate. So what happened after 9/11 is fairly typical. Because we're not trained to explore the causes of these things, we're not trained to explore our grief, what happens is typically we turn our grief into violence and rage. Instead of exploring the grief and exploring the origins, which would have been a mature response, and responding out of that, we just turn the grief into rage, which is a kind of a primitive emotional response. The problem, however, is that once you start killing other people, you increase your own fear of being killed yourself in retaliation. You start killing them, and then you're immediately afraid that they'll start killing you. You become afraid of retribution, and so more violence occurs. And so the more you resort to violence, the more you're in danger, and the more you produce another vicious circle of violence, which, of course, is what we're seeing now. So why are societies, given all that, and we know that this has been going on for thousands of years, why are societies so enthusiastic about war? When you look at the old newsreels in Europe and the United States at the beginning of World War I, and you see the old newsreels of the soldiers marching off to war, and the roads lined with cheering civilians, waving the flag and urging them on and so on. Why were millions of people at the beginning of the war so ecstatic and excited about the prospect of war? Well, what is ecstasy? Ecstasy, etymologically, ecstasis means standing outside oneself. Standing outside oneself. A loss of one's normal sense of self, a feeling of being lost in a higher order of things. Some larger order is taking over. We're part of a greater whole. The idea of war seemed to be intoxicating and apparently met some kind of need for national unity. Toynbee said that the historian said that the glorification of war becomes a kind of national religion that produces a kind of spiritual sustenance as traditional religion fades. And this, I think, is true. I think it hints at a profound spiritual process. When we are joined in a common purpose with millions of other people, we feel strong, we feel transcendent, we feel no longer isolated. We don't feel insignificant. We feel part of the totality, part of what's happening, instead of alienated and solitary and alone, which is the way many people feel in the culture when there isn't a war. So war gets rid of that feeling and makes us feel part of something larger. And then, we project this sense of power that we need into all the flag waving and the patriotism and the emotional identification with the larger group, which helps us to deny our vulnerability. If we're part of this huge group with this wonderful big strong army, and we all know what a big strong army we have and so on, we don't feel weak, we don't feel so vulnerable, we feel a part of all that strength. The problem, of course, is that the other tribe that we're fighting has the same feeling. So each tribe has its own nationalism, its own sense of this larger merger, and you simply have two tribes feeling the same way. But what the tribes are feeling is that war glues us together, as if the nation is a kind of organism where the individual cell, the individual person, doesn't really matter. The individual is just one cell in the body, and only the whole organism matter. And then when the war starts, the politicians use it to try to produce a rebirth of our national purpose and our values and so on. So we get all the talk about democracy and freedom. But the glorification of the military and the identification of the military with how powerful we are and how wonderful the generals are and so on, magically restore our potency. We've been attacked. How could they do that to us? Do they realize who we are? And then our national sense of pride is offended. And so we restore our potency by our massive military strength. I call that war as Viagra. Okay? By the way, did you hear that the Japanese are sending us cases of Viagra to help us with our election? Sorry, just a loose association, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Right. Do you want to erase that from the tape? What? Anyway, so the point is that when we're in danger, I was getting a little heavy, when we're in danger, it reduces our fear if we feel part of the larger tribe that is attacking the enemy. And of course, it helps us to feel very strong if the enemy is much weaker than we are, which is why we attack very weak countries like Iraq and Panama and Grenada and so on. And then we can be quite sure that we'll win. And then we have media propaganda, which produces a crowd psychology, what I call the CNN effect. Okay, when you have crowd psychology and mass group consciousness, you lose individual ego discrimination. And that fosters the process of the unification of the country. I remember after 9/11, the day after 9/11, there was a message on my phone answering machine from a local newspaper reporter saying, would I call him and explain to him how people were supposed to feel about 9/11? I mean, can you imagine calling a psychologist about how you're supposed to feel? I couldn't believe it, but that is honestly what happened. It's like we need to be told how to feel. Okay. Well, you see this kind of phenomenon when you have crowds and mass rallies where individual differences are no longer important. You saw that in the Nuremberg rallies, the Nazi rallies in the Second World War, where Hitler had these tens of thousands of people, and the individual was completely insignificant in that, and there's no individual consciousness. And people were giving the Nazi salute because they were completely swept away by the mass psychology of the crowd, which you remember Jung was quite terrified of, with good reason, actually. So in those kind of rallies, you see enthusiasm for war because of this nationalistic sentiment, because I think we then feel part of this larger whole. And that is emotionally so intense, it gives us a sense of transcendence. This is the spiritual dimension. The sense that we belong to something larger than the small self, in contrast to our usual sense of insignificance. Now, these are spiritual feelings. And this is very important, because when war is felt to have a spiritual underpinning, killing is righteous. If you think you're doing it in the name of God, then it's okay to kill. Many examples of that. Normal morality are what I think is actually an innate morality, sort of a Kantian notion of an innate morality, an innate moral sense, doesn't seem to apply during wartime. And the leader is able to invoke religious language by suggesting that all the dying and suffering are accepted as part of the archetypal battle of good versus evil. And of course, we're the good and they're the bad. And the shadow projection is obvious. And then killing, of course, is a sacred task. So it's okay to kill. I think this is part of the God wants blood legacy of the Hebrew Bible, I'm afraid. That's why I think that so much emphasis on animal sacrifice and the sacrifice of Jesus and so on has led to this this mythology that we have to retaliate with blood. So no wonder our cemeteries and our monuments to war are so important. They are shrines to what I think is this dangerous religion of nationalism. And toy